From Radio Vermont, it's the Dave Graham Show on WDEV. It's your show about the people, places, and the issues that matter the most to you. Now here's your host, Dave Graham.
Good morning, Vermont. It is Wednesday, February the 5th, 2020, and so glad to have you with us this morning. We got a good full slate of guests coming in. Tom Longstreth from Resource is going to be joining us in the second hour of the program. He has been running this program for more than 20 years, and it's a great example of a community partnership involving both recycling and job training, and they just built a new headquarters in Williston. So lots of good news going on about the about that organization, and we're going to be checking in with Tom Longstreth about that in the latter part of the show. In the second half hour of the program, Congressman Peter Welch joins us, and boy, does he have a lot to talk with us about. He is going to be with us talking about probably today's impeachment vote. President Trump is expected to be acquitted by the Republican-controlled Senate. Other news, of course, the State of the Union address. Congressman Welch was in the gallery in the House chamber, I should say, in last night. The president gave his speech, the State of the Union address, and we'll get some reaction from Congressman Welch about that. And of course, the presidential campaign heads along. Congressman Welch has been a supporter of Vermont's junior senator Bernie Sanders. The congressman has been, as I mentioned, an endorser. Unlike some other leading Vermont politicians, a couple of former governors recently were critical of Senator Sanders, so those being Governors Kunin, Governor Shumlin. Not big fans of Bernie Sanders, but Congressman Welch might have some differing views there, so we'll be talking with him about that. But first, I wanted to bring in a new guest on the Dave Graham Show, someone who hasn't been with us before, but I want to see if we can make him a regular, because he has got his finger on the pulse of a lot going on in the news in Vermont politics, and a lot of Vermonters know him from his regular appearances on WCAX Channel 3 out of Burlington. Adam Sullivan joins us on the phone. Good morning, Adam.
Hey, Dave. Good to be here.
And thank you so much for joining me. Yeah. So you have been doing a little traveling lately around, of course, you're based over in New Hampshire, correct?
Yeah. Office in West Lebanon, cover the New Hampshire region and, you know, southern Vermont.
Yep. And you have been dipping into some politics as the New Hampshire reporter, because there's been a little political story unfolding in New Hampshire from what I'm told.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. We're just 6 days out now from the New Hampshire primary. I was with the Sanders campaign last night, and then around noontime with the Biden campaign. Was out in Iowa for a couple weeks last week, so it's a busy time when it comes to presidential politics.
Yeah, you're a busy guy. So talk to me a little bit about Iowa, just to kind of wrap this thing up, because, I mean, I guess it's still not wrapped up there. It's a couple days out, and they're still trying to count votes over there. Was there any sign that trouble was coming when you were out there?
I mean, there was no sign that trouble was coming, and I think it's really sort of unexpected and sort of really an embarrassment for the Democratic Party in some regards regarding the confusion at the caucuses and the fact that here we are now, what, 2 days later, and there still aren't complete results. But we knew going in, I mean, one of the reasons we went to Iowa is because the caucus system is so different from, say, a New Hampshire primary. And in New Hampshire, you simply go to your, you know, local voting ballot location, whether it's a school or a town hall, you get your paper ballot or computer ballot, you mark your candidate, you put it in the box, and, you know, they count it at the end of the day. But, you know, out in Iowa, the caucus system is very different, where you're actually, it's a social gathering where you actually have to show up to these gymnasiums and churches and schoolhouses, and you physically have to stand in the corner for the candidate. And then if that candidate isn't receiving enough support, you know, 15% of the people in the room, then that sort of that corner dissolves and those candidates are brought to another corner. So we actually have a sister station, KCRG, out in Iowa. So one of the days I was out there, I interviewed one of the anchors this is her fifth Iowa caucus. And she was trying to break it down for me. But even someone who is really in tune with presidential politics, it was pretty confusing as far as delegates and precinct captains and all that stuff. So, in some regards, it's not surprising at all that there is so much confusion around the primary. It looks like at last numbers, it looks like Bernie Sanders is up with the popular vote by about 1,500 votes, but Pete Buttigieg, former mayor of South Bend, Indiana, he is in the lead slightly when it comes to actual delegates coming out of Iowa.
Why is that? Why is there this difference between delegates and popular vote there? Do you know?
I really can't tell you. All I know is it's a tradition that dates back to the early 1970s, I believe. I think it's really designed to give those passionate supporters of the candidates more of an influence on the process. Some may say that's a good thing. Some may say that's not so much of a good thing. But it really does come down to supporters. You know, those grassroots campaigns and getting people not only to the polls but really to advocate for their candidates once they're there. But there was a new app in play this year. I know that they changed some of their reporting methods. They were trying to be actually more transparent because of calls from Senator Bernie Sanders, I believe, in 2016. He just narrowly lost the Iowa caucuses to Hillary Clinton. So he was really calling for more transparency. And I think some of the changes that they made out there were in direct response to that. However, it seems like they may not have been as prepared as they should have been.
Yeah, you know, I mean, if you're a Bernie supporter, and I see some of this online, of course, a lot of Vermonters are supporters of Bernie Sanders. He does have a strong following in this state. And there's a little tinge of, I don't know if it's paranoia or if it's reasonable suspicion or whatever, but there's a lot of chatter online the last day or so, just sort of really raising eyebrows and saying, isn't it weird that this guy who, if you were going to have a straight ahead election where it's just simple selection, you know, behind a curtain, pull a lever, as we do here when we vote in Vermont, Bernie Sanders would have been declared the winner as of, you know, Tuesday night or Monday night, rather. And here we are in this weird situation where, you know, there's this sort of opportunity to rejigger everything on a second go around with these caucuses. And sure enough, somehow they figured out a way to make him not the clear winner. I mean, that's when friends of yours come to you and say they're a little suspicious about this or whatever, how do you react to that?
Well, I mean, to your point, I believe that, you know, the conspiracy theories are sort of flying around specifically in regards to Senator Sanders. A lot of people feel like he sort of got the short end of the stick in 2016 when he was facing Hillary Clinton and how that Democratic nomination process took place. And I think now coming out of Iowa, here we are, you know, Sanders was, you know, it's really sort of starting to surge in Iowa. He's already leading the polls here in New Hampshire, but he was starting to surge in Iowa. It seemed like towards the end of the, you know, the race, and here we are, we have these muddled numbers coming out of the election. So, I mean, there definitely has been a little bit of that floating around. Sanders really sort of really just skipped over it last night down in Milford. He had a huge turnout. Approximately like 1,200 people were there. And he basically just made a joke saying, "Yeah, it looks like, you know, Iowans have a little trouble counting their ballots, but we'll get them counted, and we'll move on to New Hampshire, where I'm confident the Granite Staters will be able to count their ballots here in New Hampshire." So he really didn't pay too much attention to it, and he did highlight the fact that he, you know, as far as the popular vote, he's out there. But I think actually one of the biggest, I mean, if you want to look sort of into the analysis of what's going on and the fact that, you know, you're coming out of Iowa with no clear winner. I think one of the biggest, the candidate that was probably helped the most from that was former Vice President Joe Biden. I mean, he finished a distant fourth. He's leading in national polls, but here we are, the first, you know, sort of telltale of the presidential cycle. He's finishing in fourth, and the media is not talking about that. They're talking about the fact that there are no results. So I think Joe Biden probably was the biggest benefactor as to what happened out in Iowa a couple days ago.
Yeah, I mean, some results, though, are I think, sort of obvious enough or clear enough that they can even stand out from a muddle. But you think this softens the blow that it might otherwise that Biden might otherwise be experiencing by finishing fourth in Iowa?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. I think the story would have been across the board, Biden finishes fourth. But instead, the story was, we don't know who the winner was, even though now it's looking like there are two clear front runners in the race, Pete Buttigieg and Bernie Sanders, whether, you know, if that's, or Pete Buttigieg now actually in the lead is when it comes to delegates. But yeah, I think, I think the fact that there was so much confusion out of Iowa, Joe Biden was probably the biggest benefactor of that, even though he, you know, it looks like he's got some work to do in New Hampshire to make up some ground. And I also want to add that Senator Amy Klobuchar, she sort of came from, I don't want to say out of nowhere, but she's really sort of, you know, I think her quote of the night in Iowa was, well, we punched above our weight, meaning that they did much better than expected. So when it comes to sort of momentum coming out of Iowa, I think Bernie Sanders, Pete Buttigieg, they both have momentum. I think Biden has some ground to make up, as well as Elizabeth Warren, who it appears finished third. And then Senator Amy Klobuchar, who is, you know, sort of a distant fifth, she's saying, hey, we did great, and our momentum is pretty strong going into New Hampshire. So we'll have to see. It's 6 days out.
Here's an interesting bit of perspective, though. I mean, I remember when Howard Dean finished third in the Iowa caucuses back in 2004, that pretty much, you know, everybody sort of thought from there. And, of course, part of it was the scream where he kind of, you know, lost control of himself at an awkward moment there. But, you know, he was considered to be toast by virtue of his third place finish. It doesn't seem to be a fourth place finish is hurting Biden as badly.
No, and you know, you look back to 1992 with Bill Clinton. Bill Clinton, I believe, finished fourth in Iowa.
Uh-huh.
And then went on and he didn't even win New Hampshire. He went on and finished second. But that was when his famous, you know, Bill Clinton is now the comeback kid. So
yeah.
It's really sort of like this momentum that Iowa traditionally has given candidates. But this time around, it doesn't seem like there's that much momentum. It's really going to come down to when it comes to New Hampshire and getting people out to the polls, it's really going to come down to ground game and really winning over those independent voters. Because in New Hampshire, the independent or undeclared voters are actually the largest voting block in New Hampshire, as opposed to like the Republicans or the Democrats. And in the primary, the independent voters can choose either ballot. So you can bet, because all the action is on the Democratic side, that those independent voters are all going to choose Democratic ballots. There's going to be a huge turnout for the Democrats. And really, who's going to be successful in New Hampshire will likely come down to who can win over those undeclared voters.
No big groundswell over there for Bill Weld, the governor of Massachusetts, who's trying to challenge President Trump on the Republican side.
I mean, WCAX has interviewed Bill Weld.
Yeah. WDEV.
I honestly think that there is if it's indicative of anything I found out in Iowa, there's a lot of support for President Trump. I mean, the GOP, I believe, is behind the president. One thing I thought was very interesting is that people who support President Trump don't necessarily want to go on camera and say that publicly. But I think he has really sort of this silent support that rings true in the Granite State as well. So I would be shocked if, I'm not here to make any predictions, but I would be shocked if Bill Weld gets, you know, in double digits as far as he is on the ballot, and there is going to be a Republican primary. But I really think it will be over quickly. Let's put it that way.
Yeah. But you know, one of the interesting things about New Hampshire to me, I've done a little research recently into this, and I've noticed a pattern with the Granite State, and this goes to both Iowa and New Hampshire in terms of really not being that representative of the rest of the country in terms of their picks of, and you'll see that from, you know, the fact that Bill Clinton finishes fourth in Iowa and it goes on to win the nomination. Clearly that says that Iowa maybe wasn't the wasn't making the best bets on this thing. Okay, so New Hampshire has this weird thing where if you look back across who New Hampshire voters have supported in the various primaries over time, it's amazing the degree to which basically they're homers. If you're from New England, it's a huge help.
You think back to
Ed Muskie in 1972. There's a guy who, I mean, most Americans don't even remember that name now, but he was a candidate for the presidential nomination. He won the New Hampshire Democratic primary. And, you know, his strength there, I guess, was from the fact that he was from Maine, you know.
Yeah, sure.
Another little remembered name, Paul Tsongas, was from Massachusetts, won the New Hampshire primary in 1992, and again you kind of look at that and you go, how can this be? Well, you know, he's from Lowell, Mass, about less than 30 miles downriver from Manchester.
Right.
You know, and so on and so forth. I mean, I you know, the one time I can recall a New Englander losing the New Hampshire primary was to another New Englander. That was when, of course, John Kerry of Massachusetts defeated Howard Dean of Vermont in the New Hampshire primary back in 2004. And so, if I'm the rest of the country, I might be looking at this and kind of going, what, do you got to be a Red Sox fan or what's the deal?
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I think to your point this time around, I think the pressure is really on Senator Elizabeth Warren of Massachusetts. You know, her office is probably only an hour from Manchester, the largest city in New Hampshire. And she really needs to prove that she can win over those voters pretty much in her backyard. She's got an uphill road to climb, you know, because Senator Bernie Sanders was very strong, again, to your point, versus Hillary Clinton, you know, winning by double-digit margins in 2016. Though New Hampshire hasn't really been very a good indicator as, you know, whoever wins New Hampshire goes on to win the nomination, because Hillary Clinton actually beat Barack Obama in New Hampshire back in 2008. But then Obama went on to obviously win the nomination and the White House. Whereas Iowa, for the past 20 years, Iowans have accurately predicted the Democratic nominee. That was Al Gore in 2000, John Kerry 2004, Obama 2008, and so on. So Iowa is actually the better indicator as far as who the party will choose. But this time around, obviously, it's muddled. But to your point about the sort of the demographics of these early states, Iowa and New Hampshire, it's well taken. There has been a lot of focus this time around whether these states should go first. You know, concerns about demographics and do they best represent America. And I think there are some valid concerns there. However, I'll say New Hampshire voters covet their first in the nation status, and you know, if New Hampshire were to be taken away, you know, there would be a big fight here in the Granite State, the Live Free or Die State. But also, I think, you know, these early states, I think there's something to be said about grassroots democracy. You know, when you go back to Obama was a little known senator. In 2008, he did really well in Iowa, and all of a sudden it sort of put him on the map, and it allowed him, you know, to really break through, you know, with not a lot of money and not a huge organization, because he was able to have those one-on-one voter interactions that you get in Iowa or in New Hampshire. He was able to hold those town halls, and he was a long shot candidate in some regards, and he was able to break through and beat, you know, this powerhouse Hillary Clinton.
Mm-hmm.
So it's really, you know, in my opinion, the early states really allow for those candidates, you know, for those breakthrough candidates, as opposed to, say, if a primary were to take place in like California, you know, really the only way you could run that race is if you have a private jet and you can put up millions on the air. And that's basically how the primary voting would go. So,
yeah,
I think, you know, there's concerns. I think they're valid. But at the same time, there is something to be said about grassroots democracy.
Adam is based in the West Lebanon, New Hampshire area, just across the river from Vermont, and covers a lot of different topics. I've seen you on Adam on crime stories and on just a wide range of stuff happening in the Upper Valley there. And these days you're a political reporter. You've been out to Iowa on the presidential campaign trail, and of course now in New Hampshire. Tell me about the about sort of the other big political stories that are going on and what, if any, impact they might be having in New Hampshire. You know, one, of course, is this long-running impeachment battle now, which is, I guess, going to be coming to its end today, most likely an acquittal for President Trump in the Senate. Has that been getting much attention in New Hampshire?
It really hasn't. And I think the voters, when it comes to the presidential candidates, they'll tell you that that's not really what the voters in New Hampshire want to hear. They want to hear about health care. They want to hear about jobs. They want to hear about the economy, you know, medical marijuana or legalizing marijuana, that sort of thing. But when it comes to impeachment, it really hasn't been on the radar. And, you know, New Hampshire's two senators, Senator Jean Shaheen and Senator Maggie Hassan, they've been really sort of quiet on the issue as well. I think it's fair to say, you know, they've been waiting to, quote unquote, hear the evidence and cast their vote, which we'll obviously find out today how that goes. But when it comes to actual presidential campaigning, that's not necessarily, I don't think, what voters in the Granite State want to talk about.
Are you surprised by this at all? I mean, maybe it could be that it's more of a general election issue, but you know, I think with all the stuff swirling around the president, not just these two articles of impeachment, but you know, the fact that Michael Cohen, his former lawyer, is now in jail. Several former aides to the president are actually incarcerated. You know, I think as of a couple of months ago when I last checked. He was up to his team, you know, the folks involved in getting him elected and then early running in the administration. I think there have been 27 criminal convictions so far, which puts him on slightly ahead of the pace of Richard Nixon at this time in Nixon's presidency or this far in. And I'm just wondering, I mean, are you surprised at all that none of the Democratic candidates, if they haven't, have really been sort of talking about you know, why? I don't know. You could call it almost a crime spree or something.
Well, Nancy Pelosi ripped up his State of the Union speech last night, right?
So, yeah.
Yeah, I think the folks who are going after the president have their channels and can do it very publicly. But you know, here in New Hampshire, on the ground, again, I think the president has a lot of support. He going back to the primary and last time around. He won the primary, you know, he won the primary by a pretty good margin from what I can remember. Mm-hmm. I was down at a rally in Manchester. I want to say a couple months ago. I sort of lose track of time here on the campaign trail. It's something new every day.
It's all a blur.
But yeah, it's all a blur. But you know, he had a rally at Southern New Hampshire University. Or the arena down there in Manchester, and it was packed. I mean, there was 10,000 people in there, and granted, you know, a lot of people were coming up from Massachusetts and whatnot, to see the president. But you know, I think the president has a lot of support. I think he was actually upset that he lost. I mean, he makes a point to you know to talk about New Hampshire. He was upset he lost in the general election to Hillary Clinton. Mm-hmm. He's planning another rally right before, I believe, the primary. Next week here in New Hampshire, and I think the president is really good on the stump. He's really good getting out there and you know, doing his thing in front of the cameras and in front of packed audiences. So
for sure,
I you know, as far as the national politics go, I think that one, that's not what Granite Staters are interested in, and two, I do think that there is a lot of support, even if it's quiet support, but there's a lot of support for the president.
Adam Sullivan, I got to go, unfortunately. I'd love to chat more, but I thank you so much for your participation this morning.
Yeah, anytime, David.
Adam Sullivan at Channel 3, folks. Great job by him. We're going to go to some CBS News at the bottom of the hour.
The Warren Store is a warm and welcoming oasis during the winter. Our wood stove is roaring. The aromas of fresh-made soups and our daily specials fill the air. The coffee is hot and the pastries are fresh. Stop by for breakfast before you hit the slopes or make us your après-ski choice to relax and refuel after a day of fun on the mountain. And we have a great selection of grab-and-go meals if you can't stay and chat. But we hope that you can stick around. The Warren Store. We're funky, friendly, and almost world-famous.
News Radio WDEV FM and AM. Now back to the Dave Graham Show.
We are back, and I think we got a few minutes here to take a couple listener calls. If anybody feels so moved, I would like to weigh in here on the big developments in the news. Obviously, we had a little State of the Union address last night from the President of the United States, Donald Trump. We had a vote coming up today and this afternoon in the Senate where it is pretty much guaranteed that the Senate will vote, not achieve the 67-vote majority it would need to convict and remove the president from office in his impeachment trial, which has been unfolding in the last couple of months. I believe that vote is scheduled for 4 p.m. this afternoon. There's going to be a lot of live special coverage on WDEV, FM, and AM related to that. The other big news we have here is the electoral politics going on. We had the Iowa caucuses Monday evening. I guess they're still not completely done counting the votes in the Hawkeye state, and that's got to be a kind of a black eye. It really is a black eye for the state of Iowa and the Democratic Party there, and you know, a lot of snark about how if they can't run an election, how are they going to run your healthcare system and so on. That especially coming from there was a tweet about that from the president's son yesterday morning. And you know, I think that actually there is a legitimate complaint to be made about these Iowa caucuses even before they ran into the problem with the app they were trying to use this year to have the votes collected via smartphone. The Iowa caucuses and caucuses in general just seem to me to fly in the face of the idea of a secret ballot in the United States. I mean, people are supposed to be able to vote without being bothered by others while they're in the process of voting. But apparently in this presidential selection process, you go and stand in a corner of a public hall, a school gymnasium or whatever. And if you're a candidate, the one you first prefer does not achieve 15% of the vote in that caucus, then you are open. It's open season on you for the other candidates to come by and try to lobby you and get you to go to their corners of the caucus hall. And so it just strikes me that there's a lot of invitation there to, potential, I don't want to say browbeating or intimidation, but just a lot of pressure being put on people who are not used to being pressured in a political sense. If you're a legislator and used to being chased down the hall by lobbyists or something, that's one thing. But if you are just a citizen who wants to go out and participate in this democratic process and suddenly have people pressuring you to, oh, come over to my candidate or come over to that candidate, I think that the process just has some flaws, frankly. That's my own personal take on that situation. Obviously, if listeners out there like it or think there are some benefits to, some people like the idea of kind of a public discussion of who to vote for and that sort of thing. But certainly no, in states with primaries, there's plenty of time for if people who want to be public about whom they're supporting, they can go to these various forums and so on. Take New Hampshire as an example of a state that runs a primary instead of caucuses. And folks in New Hampshire could be exactly as public as they want or as not public as they want. On they can wait till primary day, go down to their town hall or the school gymnasium or wherever the vote is being held and get their ballot and fill it out and do so in secret in the traditional American way. And they can just be counseled by their own conscience rather than somebody who is coming over from a far corner of the room to tell you, oh, no, you don't want to support the person you came here to support. You want to support my person. And wow, what a bizarre scenario. I don't know. It just strikes me as an odd way to begin a presidential selection or election process. I want to introduce my next guest. What's the line, I think, from Letterman? My next guest needs no introduction, especially not in Vermont. He is the congressman in Vermont since about 2007, I believe, he was first sworn into that office, and his name is Peter Welch, and he joins me on the telephone. Good morning, Congressman.
Good morning.
How are you doing?
I'm doing good. I'm always doing good when I'm with you.
All righty. Well, we have a lot to talk about. Tons of news going on, and I don't know where you want to start, but I guess later on today. I'm sorry?
You're in charge of that.
Okay. Later on this afternoon, the Senate is expected to acquit President Donald Trump of the charges that you nefarious House Democrats brought against him, and that'll be that. And the president will sail off into the sunset or something toward his reelection. What do you make of all this?
I think that what is at stake here is about how we are defining our democracy and what our expectations are on the rule of law and on the constitutional doctrine of separation of powers and co-equal branches of government. That's really what's at stake here. The heart of the impeachment matter really goes to this constitutional question. The president acknowledged pretty clearly that he did make an effort to get the Ukraine government to do an investigation into a political rival. And that's about using the power of public office for personal gain. The defense, which ultimately is going to be successful in the Senate, was that he's the president And if he thinks doing something like that is in the national interest, he can. That's really bluntly how Alan Dershowitz, his attorney, put it. And that's what worries me, because whatever side of the case you're on, I think all of us have to remind ourselves that this democracy that we have and that we all cherish is fragile. And it has depended on both sides or all sides acknowledging that no one is above the law and acknowledging that having a separation of powers and competing branches of government is essential to maintaining our democratic tradition. So I'm going to be very disappointed about this, and it's not just because of the outcome, but it's because the way Mitch McConnell defined his job, it was essentially to be an extension of the White House in the defense, as opposed to acting as an independent institution of government, charged with the responsibility of examining the evidence and coming to an honest, independent conclusion.
You know, I also wonder whether I seriously doubt there's really any stomach for this at this point, but there are other things that the House, you know, at least theoretically, could have charged in articles of impeachment, and still could, I suppose, if it wanted to craft new articles. I mean, we think back to the alleged campaign finance violations and the payoffs to Stormy Daniels and Karen McDougal. Michael Cohen is in jail for that stuff now. He's a co-conspirator with somebody called Individual One. Individual One is in the White House. And so, you know, one sort of seems like a logical question would be, why wouldn't there be an article of impeachment based on whether, I don't know whether that's a high crime or a misdemeanor or whatever, but what about it?
Well, there's been a lot of Monday morning quarterbacking about how we proceeded. You know, some folks said that we should have just taken as much time as it took to go through the courts. Other folks have said we should have had many other articles that would have been considered, like the so-called, like the bribery and like what you were just mentioning.
Mm-hmm.
Frankly, I don't think it would have made any difference. And here's why. The defense that President Trump offered would have been the same no matter what the charges were.
Yeah.
And it was the Dershowitz defense. It was that I'm the president and I can do this. As long as I believe what I'm doing is in the national interest, I can do it. And you, Congress, can't stop me. You have nothing to say about it. That's the heart of what this defense is. And that's why it would not, in my view, have made any difference tactically how the House proceeded.
Yeah, I mean, the president's guilt or innocence was determined on Election Day 2018 when a Republican Senate was returned to Washington. I mean, that's the bottom line there. But I'm just talking about in terms of actually making a statement by the U.S. House of Representatives that certain things are high crimes and misdemeanors and shouldn't go unnoticed. You know, and I mean, I guess that's why I wondered about, you know, should there be an article of impeachment crafted out of the 10 instances of obstruction of justice found by Robert Mueller in volume 2 of his report, or, you know, the pretty clear emoluments clause violations that the president has committed by sort of wink, wink, nod, urging people to use his hotel in Washington if they want to come in.
Well, you know, Dave, I agree with that.
Yeah.
The Mueller report, for most people didn't read it,
mm-hmm.
but it documented 10 instances of the president obstructing that investigation. And obstruction of justice, of course, is an impeachable offense, and that's that was charged against Richard Nixon. The emoluments clause, it's really astonishing. You know, morning jog, I run by the Trump Hotel, and it's just filled, and we all know who's there, and it's all the folks trying to get some favor, most of them foreigners from the Trump government, and that's money that goes into the pockets of the Trump family. I think
yeah.
It's a report that Ivanka Trump took $4 million out of the profits of that hotel. So those are all things that I frankly find pretty alarming, but the heart of the question is not just that individual conduct. It's the defense, the Dershowitz defense, I'll call it, but it's really what the president embraced, and that is that he, under Article 2, is the president, and as president, he can pretty much do what he wants. That's
yep.
exactly what Dershowitz said. So we could, you and I could have this discussion, you should have charged A or B or C,
mm-hmm.
but if the defense is, it doesn't matter, because I can do what I want, because I'm president. that goes to the heart of the constitutional framework that has served us so well.
Yeah, I mean, I guess my real question isn't so much should have or would have or could have, but it's could you still? Because, I mean, there's nothing in the Constitution that says that having gone through this process once or in the connection with the two articles that were charged, just imagine a year from now, we have a newly sworn in Democratic majority in the Senate and a newly sworn in Democratic majority in the House. President Trump is reelected. Could this stuff be dusted off?
Well, theoretically, it could. Practically and politically, I think it'd be very unlikely.
Yeah.
Theoretically, it could.
Yeah. That's the point I think is worth noting. And I don't know whether I tend to agree with you, especially if he is reelected by anything that looks like, you know, a clear majority of voters and so on. It would be very, very difficult at that point for Democrats in Congress to pursue, unless there were fresh stuff. I mean, just for one example, since the articles in the House, we cleared the House, the two articles of impeachment, there was this retweeting of the whistleblower's name by the president. Now, that's, I'm told, a violation of the Federal Whistleblower Protection Act, illegal in and of itself.
Right.
So in other words, there could be further crimes, right?
Well, sure. I mean, the president is unrestrained in his behavior. You know, that's one of the things that's been important in leaders, whether it's a governor or a president, but somebody who runs an organization, is not just to be aggressive and do what you want. It's to exercise restraint, to preserve the norms of civility, of honesty, of integrity, norms that are really essential to the well-being of our country. And the president prides himself on trashing the norms. And there's some appeal for some voters who just like his attack on political correctness. But operating within guidelines and with guardrails in respect for the point of view of others is really essential to the well-being and the long-term sustainability of our democracy. And where you've got a president who is violating the law on protecting whistleblower identity, that's an astonishing thing, because even a lot of the Republicans, Senator Grassley among them, from Iowa, he knows how important whistleblowers are to governmental accountability. And that's why we have in law protections on the identity of the whistleblower. So when you've got the head of our government flouting that law, and in fact putting, I think, that whistleblower in some personal jeopardy because of the president whipping up all the anger about what that person did when he came forward, that's my view. That's non-presidential.
Now, let's shift gears here a little bit and talk about last night's State of the Union address, because you were just mentioning civility and the idea of reaching out and trying to accommodate the views of others who may disagree with you and so on and so forth. How did the president score on those ideas in his State of the Union address last night?
Well, two things. Number one, and this is common, the president was touting all his accomplishments. And
yep.
If you listen to him, we've never had a better economy for everybody.
Mm-hmm.
And I just got to say, that's not my experience. You know, before the day of the speech, the day before, I've been up in Barton, Vermont, and in Newport, Vermont. And about a week ago, I was in Bradford. And I'll tell you, people are struggling there. They're working hard. They're working together. But whatever economy the president was talking about, there's a lot of Vermonters, especially in our rural parts of our state, that it's news to them that everything is so rosy. I mean, the fact is, he hasn't done anything about infrastructure. He talked about it last night, but the infrastructure got dropped as a serious agenda item by Mitch McConnell when he told the press the day after the passage of that tax cut that added $2 trillion to our deficit. Senator McConnell said, we don't have any money. So what I'm seeing is that the president is boasting about what he claims is this greatest economy. But those folks I was with in Newport, and by the way, a lot of those folks up there support President Trump, but those folks are not all on this staircase to heaven with these high stock valuations. They're struggling trying to pay their bills each month. Wages are flat. And I see that in many parts of rural America and in rural Vermont. So I was really disappointed that there was so much time spent bragging about things that, frankly, in many cases were wrong. But rather than focusing on what's the challenge we have together, because the challenges we have in rural Vermont, when I talk to my Republican colleagues, they have the same challenges there. You know, their community hospitals are really struggling. They don't have 5G. In many cases, they have no G on the Internet.
No G.
It's really true.
Yeah.
But, you know, what you need from what leadership is about is defining what that challenge is that we have to face and doing it together. It's not dividing us, and it's not giving these statistics that are very misleading. There's parts of our country that are doing incredibly well, and folks who are in the stock market have seen their assets increase significantly. But everyday people, or our farmers, it's really, really hard. And I don't blame Trump for the state of the economy. But I do say that as president, he's got responsibility to speak the truth about the challenges that we face and to invite all of us who are willing to work to try to address them to work together to get something done.
Already in the last few minutes here, I did want to get you to talk a little bit about our junior senator from Vermont and his presidential campaign, Bernie Sanders, of course. Have you endorsed him again this time? I know you were a Sanders delegate at the 16 convention.
I have endorsed Bernie.
Okay. And what did you make of a couple of weeks ago when a couple of former governors of Vermont, of people I'm sure you know well and worked with in the legislature and so on, Peter Shumlin, Madeline Cunin, came out with critical remarks about Bernie Sanders?
I really didn't make anything of it. Bernie's in the race for the presidency, and some folks support him in the Democratic Party, and a lot of Democrats don't. And Peter and Madeline are not Bernie supporters, so they spoke their mind, and that's part of what a campaign and a campaign debate is about. Bernie's doing well, but he's got a long way to go from where he is to where he wants to get. He appears to have received the most votes in Iowa, and the second most delegates, very close to Pete Buttigieg. He's doing well in New Hampshire. Some polls I've seen recently and even today has him out front. But it is an enormous challenge. And once you get up to that tier where you're in the front runner, near front runner, then folks who don't support you start speaking out. So I think Bernie can expect he's going to get more of that as he goes along.
Yeah, you know, one of the things that struck me as a longtime reporter about the Politico interview in which Peter Shumlin was quoted as saying that Bernie Sanders plays dirty. What bugged me about that story in Politico was it didn't provide any examples. I mean, the obvious question to ask once somebody says so-and-so plays dirty is give me some examples. What do you have any anecdotes showing where he played dirty? Do you have any sense of Sanders having played dirty over the years here in Vermont?
Listen, I'm not the one who made that statement. That's
okay, I understand. But
so you give Peter a call.
I've tried, believe me. The other Peter, yeah.
That's right.
Yeah, I did try to reach out to him, I think, the day after I saw that to say, let's do a little follow-up here on the Dave Graham Show, and I haven't tracked him down yet. But the offer remains out there. If he happens to be listening this morning, Governor Shumlin, I would certainly love to have you on the show and talk to us about, I'm happy to entertain whatever the facts are, and if there are facts to support this.
Listeners want to hear it, too.
Yeah, facts to support this rather broad statement, let's have them out there, you know. And then Madeline Cunin, I thought her statement was kind of funny, too, because she said that she quoted remarked that she was shocked when Sanders came out and said, I would be a better governor for women than Madeline Cunin. This was way back in 1986, I believe it was, when he was an independent running against in a three-way race between Madeline Cunin, the Republican Peter Welch, Peter Smith, excuse me, another Peter, Peter Smith and Bernie Sanders. So that was his remark, and she was shocked by that. And just again, it struck me as that.
Right.
It is possible, isn't it, for a male candidate to be maybe better, particularly for, let's say, for women who are maybe liberal and support support reproductive rights, just for one example.
Well, of course. I mean, there can be a lot of women who are much better on family issues or issues affecting men than men are.
Mm-hmm.
And there can be. So it's all particular. We know that.
Yeah.
But, yeah, there was some hard feelings. That was a tough campaign. Madeline running for re-election in 1986 and
yep.
Bernie jumping in the race as an independent. And that was and you know, he only got, as I remember, about 14% of the vote.
But I do remember his famous quote.
No one, by the way, questions Madeline's credentials as one of our leading advocates for women and women empowerment.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, I remember Bernie's famous quote, which I think really set the tone for years afterward for his relations with Democrats, was to call the Republicans of the Democratic Party Tweedledum and Tweedledee. I don't remember which was which, but that was not a popular statement for many Democrats in Vermont at the time, and I think kind of stuck with him for a long time following. But here he is. He's one of the front runners for the Democratic nomination for president, so who knows?
Right. No, he is, and he gets a, you know, I was over in New Hampshire introducing him at one of his rallies, and what I was struck by was his tone of voice was lower than, you know, the Bernie we're used to, I thought quite empathetic, and frankly, I think he's got, it's a good approach for him to try to reach out to more people.
He's mellowing with age. Congressman Peter Welch, unfortunately, we have to jump top of the hour here, but I appreciate you taking the time with us this morning. Always good to chat.
All right. Thank you.
Take care.
Bye.
Let's go to some CBS News at the top of the hour. We'll be back with more of the Dave Graham Show to follow.
The Warren Store is a warm and welcoming oasis during the winter. Our wood stove is roaring, the aromas of fresh-made soups and our daily specials fill the air, the coffee is hot and the pastries are fresh. Stop by for breakfast before you hit the slopes or make us your après-ski choice to relax and refuel after a day of fun on the mountain. And we have a great selection of grab-and-go meals if you can stay and chat, but we hope that you can stick around. The Warren Store. We're funky, friendly, and almost world-famous.
It's the Dave Graham Show on WDEV.
We are back, and we have an interesting hour of radio still to go here on the Wednesday morning Dave Graham Show. We're going to be talking in a few minutes with Tom Longstreth. He is with Resource, which is an organization based in Williston, but it really operates with a much bigger footprint than that. And they do work in recycling and also job training. We'll be talking with Tom about that in a few minutes. Up until then, I'm hoping we can get shortly a telephone call with Elena Treen. She is with Axios and has been a guest on the program, I think, a couple times before here now. Really enjoying our new connection with this online news service, Axios. They are have a national footprint. They actually are also really worth a look if you are out there looking for new, good news sources. They have a real down-the-middle delivery of news. I don't note a lot of political bias, either liberal or conservative. With them, they also write really tightly in a way that keeps you up to date on what's going on in the national scene, in the world scene. In addition, just a lot of really interesting issues they kind of delve into, stuff that might surprise you, various aspects of business and energy and media news, etc. So it's a good outfit, Axios, and well worth a look. Axios.com. Check them out. I believe Elena Treen from Axios is on the phone with us this morning. Good morning, Elena.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm doing well. How are you?
I'm good, thanks. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, so lots of big political news all coming at us. It reminds me of the book I read back in high school called Future Shock by Alvin Toffler, how events were just going to speed up like crazy in the coming decades. And I sometimes think this guy had it right way back in the 1970s or whatever that was. But Elena, tell me your reaction to last night's State of the Union address, first off.
It was very different. I'd use that word. Very different from past State of the Union addresses, where the polarization right now on Capitol Hill and within Washington has reached a peak, and we saw that last night on the House floor. The tension in the room, I was there inside the room last night, and you could just feel the tension with, you know, Republicans standing repeatedly to give the president applause while Democrats sat audibly groaning and, you know, at some point even saying no out loud when he was speaking. And it continued after. And obviously, one of the biggest acts of defiance from Democrats was when House Speaker Nancy Pelosi tore President Trump's speech in half. I believe it was four times.
Yep.
when the State of the Union address concluded.
I'm not sure what to make of that. I sort of look at that and I go, well, here's somebody who has, her entire career has really been, I think the fair adjective for most of her behavior over time has been decorous. You know, she always comes across like somebody who's very much in control of her own emotions and kind of expects others around her to be the same, and is really someone who wants to set an example for the utmost in civil behavior and that sort of thing. Was this off her reservation, or was this okay?
Well, you know, I think one thing that is really important to keep in mind with Speaker Pelosi, some people are like, oh, she wasn't thinking, or this was so out of character for her. But she is not in the position she is without knowing exactly what she's doing. She's one of the most, if not the most, politically savvy politicians in D.C. And she did that while President Trump was still standing in front of her, in front of all of the cameras. And so, in my view, she knew exactly what she was doing. And I think that it was, like some people said last night, an act of defiance. Now, I did ask some Democratic leaders, like the majority leader, Steny Hoyer, as well as Congressman Hakeem Jeffries, both were in leadership, about her ripping up the speech, and they refused to comment on it after the State of the Union address, saying, you know, they kind of took a cop out, saying, we haven't seen it personally, so I can't comment on it.
Yeah.
I did talk to Carolyn Maloney. She's now the chairwoman of Oversight Committee, and she said she thinks that, you know, it showed how angry the speaker was with some of the president's misstatements, and that, you know, she clearly was really frustrated, and that is out of the norm for her, but obviously up to her to express herself that way.
Yeah, it was really striking, and it was kind of an interesting piece of performance art. And again, I'm not really feeling critical of it right now. I'm also not feeling like, wow, what a brilliant maneuver. It's kind of got me a little bit amused. I'm not sure what the exactly how to describe it, but
I think most people will agree with you. No one was expecting that. I can tell you that for sure. She definitely did not inform any of her members or telling them that she planned to do that before walking in there. So I think you could hear some audible gasps in the room from people when she did that.
You know, it strikes me too that she probably came up with that plan during the speech. I doubt she was planning on that before the speech, but then the tone of the speech itself was it seemed to be tearing at something, didn't it?
It did, and I think it shows where the president is standing right here. He feels like he is getting stronger right now, not weaker, despite this entire impeachment process.
Mm-hmm.
And it really was a play to – it was a political speech, really, and that's you could tell from in the room. He was standing up there, definitely a bit more sophisticated from a – rhetoric standpoint than he has been on the campaign trail or at some of his rallies, but it did, the words and the message that he brought forward did come off to me sound similarly to one of his rallies. And I think that, you know, it was just clear from the speech, it wasn't an olive branch or even a nod to bipartisanship last night. It was really a very highly partisan speech that was geared toward not only his reelection campaign, but also vindication for what he thinks has been a witch hunt against him.
Yeah, and I guess, the underlying message to me seemed to be, hey, Democrats, I'm beating you, and it's going to get worse.
Exactly. And I think, you know, it was, I spoke with a lot of people, Republicans included, and some folks at the White House prior to the speech who were wary that he wouldn't be able to resist taking a victory lap on impeachment, but he actually did not mention the I word once last night, although you could hear there were definitely undertones pointing to that in his address. But it was surprising to me as well, it wasn't mentioned once in his prepared remarks, but the president does like to riff during these speeches. And so I wouldn't have been surprised if he, you know, weaved in some sort of remark regarding impeachment, but he stuck to the script. And I know that a lot of Republicans and folks at the White House were happy that he resisted that temptation.
Yeah. Among the other big political stories this week, Iowa caucuses now heading into New Hampshire primaries. The Iowa caucuses, how bad is this for the Democrats to look like they can't really organize something like this?
It was a massive, massive blunder for the Iowa Democratic Party, and it's going to be interesting to see how they try to recover now moving forward. Of course, you know, one of the biggest issues is because of their app, and they said that they were rolling this new app out for the first time, and that had some coding issues and other issues with that, and then because they were relying on the app, that the telephones weren't properly staffed. So it was a big screw, and it could, you know, some people are saying this could shine a light on whether they need to make serious changes to the caucus process itself in coming years. I think that's still too early to determine, but it was entirely embarrassing for them. And we've seen Republicans, you know, gave them great fodder, the president himself, you know, not hesitating to blast the Iowa Democratic Party on Twitter for this process. And so they'll be dealing with this for some time. And it's also unfortunate because, you know, candidates who do well there, and it's normally a really great jumping off point for people like someone like Mayor Pete Buttigieg, who clearly did very well last night, same with Senator Bernie Sanders, they would normally really ride a strong wave into New Hampshire after Iowa, and they were kind of robbed of that opportunity. Alternatively, you know, you have someone like former Vice President Joe Biden, who didn't do as well, that probably got a bit of a pass there, that, you know, there's more discussion right now of the big mess up with the Iowa process rather than who is failing or trailing behind right now.
Yeah, I was interested to note that, you know, back in 2004, a third place finish in Iowa for Howard Dean was pretty much considered fatal. Of course, there was the famous Dean scream, too, which didn't help. But his third place finish was considered fatal. This time, a fourth place finish for Joe Biden, as you say, he seems to be getting a pass.
Right, exactly. And it is, I mean, I have to say this, like, it's remarkable, truly, when you do look at Iowa's always been a huge, you know, we've seen it propelled former President Barack Obama to the presidency, like it has with so many other past presidents. And to see someone like Pete Buttigieg, someone from a small town, South Bend, Indiana mayor, come out ahead of three senators and a former vice president is pretty remarkable. And so in the same point of where someone like former Vice President Joe Biden did get a pass there and is going to try to kind of bury his trailing behind in the mess of the technical difficulties they had, someone like Pete Buttigieg is really going to struggle to show that this is as big a deal as it really is, and it should be, like it has been in past years, despite the difficulties that they've had.
Of course, some of the online chatter I see up here in Vermont, of course, the home state of Bernie Sanders, where Sanders has just a ton of very passionate support. It's interesting to me to watch this because, you know, he did win the popular vote on the first go-around in the caucuses, I guess. And of course, then they have this convoluted process, which results in more delegates going to Pete Buttigieg. Overlaid on top of that are all these technical problems with the app and the fact they still haven't actually finished the county even as we speak, and so on and so forth. And, you know, some of the more paranoid elements of the Sanders backers here in Vermont, if you look at the online traffic, it's sort of like, yeah, well, they had to figure out a way to deny Bernie Sanders the win. Do they have any reason for this sort of sense, paranoia maybe, if you want to call it that?
I think that there's always paranoia when it comes to these things, especially when it comes when we've seen these technical difficulties and the snafus that happened in Iowa. There's always paranoia that, were there other vulnerabilities or other motivations behind what happened and the way that this is playing out now. But I think with Senator Sanders, you know, he did still do very, very well in Iowa. And he, we believe, is right now best positioned to win New Hampshire as well. So the bigger question really is what's going to happen to the other candidates, like the underperforming Joe Biden and others who need to convince donors to still keep them afloat despite the past showing that they've had in Iowa. And so that's something to definitely watch moving forward. But it's understandable that some of these vulnerabilities and technical difficulties in these systems do create some level of paranoia among voters to ensure that their vote really counts and it's counting toward the candidate that they want it to.
You know, the in New Hampshire, there's always a neighboring state bump. I mean, if you think back to all of the candidates for New England over the years, I think the only one I can think of who actually lost the New Hampshire primary was Howard Dean in 2004, of course, to John Kerry from Massachusetts. So, you know, Ed Muskie in 72 won the New Hampshire primaries from Maine, and Paul Tsongas in 92 from Massachusetts, and so on, but being from a neighboring state of Minnesota didn't seem to help Amy Klobuchar in Iowa.
It didn't, and that was something that it wasn't totally surprising, as we knew heading into Iowa how strong some of the top candidates were who performed very well there. But she hasn't been able to pull ahead there. She's continuing to say, you know, we're focusing ahead on the following states, but it will be interesting to see. Normally after Iowa, after New Hampshire, we see a lot of top candidates starting to drop out and the race really narrow. And so that's expected to happen here. But again, I mean, the technical difficulties that happened in Iowa could actually prevent some candidates from doing that. They might use that as a way to downplay their underperformance in the state and yep. use it as a way to stay in the race. But that's totally right. And I definitely expect in New Hampshire we'll see people like Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren, like you said, from neighboring states, do very well there. And I think that's why a lot of candidates actually spent stunningly little time campaigning in New Hampshire, because Senators Sanders and Warren do appear so strong there. So right. I think the notion that their neighboring states for sure will help them, but also just the nature of their campaigns playing really well there as well.
Right. Well, Elena Treen of Axios, I want to thank you so much for joining me this morning. It's always good talking with you. Let's do it again soon.
Yes, thank you so much for having me. It's always a pleasure.
All righty. My next guest is Tom Longstrath. He is the longtime executive director of an organization called Resource, which is involved in a lot of different things in Vermont, mainly recycling of a wide variety of materials. We can talk some about that, as well as job training. Resource is very much doing that kind of work as well. And the other news from this organization is that they have just recently opened a new headquarters in Williston and changed their footprint a little bit, but definitely still very, very active and ready to get into their next chapter. Tom Longstrath, thank you for coming in this morning. Appreciate you doing so.
Hey, Dave, thank you so much for having us, having me. Appreciate the opportunity to tell folks a little bit more about Resource and our three-part mission.
And so let's see. The history here goes way back to what, the early 90s?
Or? Well, yeah, my history starts in 1996, but I was actually the third executive director. Resource was first incorporated as Recycle North. We were incorporated by founded by this. The founder was Ron Krupp in Burlington. Mm-hmm. The vision he had was really developed because there was a crisis of homelessness as well as a huge amount of waste happening. And so he said, "Well, let's have less waste and create more opportunity for these homeless men." At the time, all the first trainees we had were men, and we kept things out of the landfill. We recycled, recovered, you know, reused reusable furniture, and we also started a job training program in appliance repair. And so that program started in 1991. That's when it was incorporated. Really was a tiny organization first few years, a lot of volunteer help, a lot of effort. Ron left after about 2.5 years, and a board member stepped in, ran it for another 2.5 or 3 years, and then I was hired in 1996. And at that time, you know, I remember we had, I think, 8 staff, and we'd sit around a picnic table every Tuesday morning and had our staff meetings. Uh-huh. And, you know, the three parts of the mission, the poverty relief, the job training, and the environmental stewardship, were all sort of incorporated into this running a thrift store and running a reuse operation. Mm-hmm. But we had Pete Bickmore, who is still with us, is our longtime appliance trainer. He's a technician, and we fix major appliances and teach. At first, it was homeless men, but now it's men and women, homeless, not homeless, people who are on public assistance want to get a good, stable job. And we are teaching them critical skills so they can become employed. And so that first program in appliance repair really has expanded. And now we teach construction training. We do weatherization work. We've done solar installation training. And it really runs the gamut of types of individuals, 50-year-old men, 16-year-old boys, and mm-hmm. men and women. We really cover a broad category of people who want to be employed, want to work, but lack some critical skills. And that's what we're trying to do, is connect them to those employers who are also desperate for workers. And we just have a crisis in the construction industry in particular.
Let's talk some more about that. But first, let's bring in a listener who's on the line calling in, Jim from Chelsea. Good morning, Jim.
Thanks for taking my call. Another great show, Dave.
Thanks.
This goes to the Restore. I think it's a terrific place to go. And if anybody else, well, not anybody else, I hope other people are listening. I got a $3,500 GE Profile Arctica refrigerator for sale for $350. It's an excellent refrigerator. I got a brand new scratched and dent GE dishwasher for $450. And you can get some really good buys there. My question to you guys at the Restore, what about opening up a shop up near Irisburg, Newport, Craftsbury, Lowell, Derby area? There's a lot of people up there that would like to go to Williston, but just don't feel, you know, they can afford to go there.
Well, you know, that, let me tell you, we actually have sites in Williston, Burlington on Pine Street, where Barrie and Hyde Park. So we're not in the, you know, we're not further north or further east than Hyde Park, but we are in Hyde Park. We've got a great site there. Also, a little just clarification: we actually gave up the name Restore to Habitat for Humanity. So we are no longer use the word or the name, the brand, Restore.
Okay.
Habitat for Humanity has 500 affiliates or so across the country.
They
have the Restore brand and name. We're good partners with the Habitat, and actually our Youth Build program has built about a dozen units of affordable housing with Habitat for Humanity, but we're just different organizations.
Okay, one last point. In fact,
both Resource and Habitat for Humanity have thrift stores in Williston. So there's actually two right there
stores
in Williston. But we would love to grow to the Northeast Kingdom, and I think that's an opportunity now that we've sort of secured our headquarters.
Oh, good.
Dave was just saying that we just managed to buy the building we moved into 2 years ago.
Yeah.
We really had a crisis of our own housing crisis.
Sure.
You know, we were searching for the right combination of spaces for about 5 years and finally managed to do it in 2018. We were renting at first, but our agreement with the landlord was that we could buy the space after 2 years.
So Resource is different than, you say you're in Habitat for Humanity now?
No, sorry. Habitat for Humanity is separate. The Restore, that name went
Restore,
to Habitat for Humanity.
Oh.
Resource, a nonprofit community enterprise, runs four different household goods and thrift stores and building material reuse sites in Vermont. One of which is in Williston on Harvest Lane, another in Burlington, 339 Pine Street.
Yeah.
And then another in Barrie, 30 Granite Street.
Yeah, I go to that one all the time.
Yeah. And then the final one is out in Hyde Park.
Okay. Well, you're hired. You're doing a great job, and I'll hang up and listen from now on. Thanks.
Awesome.
Thanks for the call, Jim. Appreciate it. Yeah, that is. I think there is some confusion out there, as we just heard, between Resource and Restore. Did at some point did Resource sort of take over some Restore operations in Vermont? Or
well, no, the history. I mean, so I was telling you, you know, Resource started as Recycle North.
Mm-hmm.
In we took on a there's we've actually absorbed two other nonprofit organizations that were struggling, and were able to bring in their services, maintain their services, and expand them. One was Youth Building for the Future in Burlington. They were running a youth build program. We absorbed that into our programs. And it really made sense because we were doing building material reuse and we wanted to do construction training. And so the youth build was a great fit for that.
I want to talk more about the job training programs. We got to go to a bottom of the hour break for some CBS News right now. A couple words from our sponsors, then we can continue our conversation with Tom Longstreth of Resource in just a few minutes, folks.
The Warren Store is a warm and welcoming oasis during the winter. Our wood stove is roaring, the aromas of fresh-made soups and our daily specials fill the air, the coffee is hot and the pastries are fresh. Stop by for breakfast before you hit the slopes or make us your après-ski choice to relax and refuel after a day of fun on the mountain. And we have a great selection of grab-and-go meals if you can stay and chat, but we hope that you can stick around. The Warren Store. We're funky, friendly, and almost world famous.
Now back to the Dave Graham Show on WDEV, FM, and AM.
My guest is Tom Longstreth. He's Executive Director of Resource. It is an organization with facilities in Williston, Hyde Park, Burlington, Barry. Am I missing any,
Tom? Those are the four of them.
Four of them right now. And just opened, a facility you moved into a couple of years ago in Williston. So congratulations on that achievement. And Resource, you mentioned, has a three-part mission, which is to help people in poverty work their way out of poverty. It's to provide job training and also to do good environmental work in terms of recycling and that sort of thing. And fair to say that it started with all three missions in mind from day one?
It did. I mean, the training programs have developed, more and more. We have two classes of job training programs. One is work experience, and the second is workforce development. The workforce development programs, the outcome that we're looking for is employment, and we're trying to place those trainees into a job when they graduate. And, it really is a bridge between employers who are desperate to have skilled workers and disadvantaged individuals who can't seem to, find work because they lack critical skills, don't have needed experiences, or for whatever other reason. We've got long-term, year-long training programs that really do wraparound instruction and skill building. And then we've got some very intensive short-term 6-week programs, which really very quickly can move someone from maybe a dead-end job, they're not making much, it's very unstable work, into a real career, like in construction, like in weatherization. And we're, in fact, going to be doing some new intensives. We call these short-term classes, 6-week programs, in manufacturing later this year. So we're really trying to create and fill the gaps where people, job seekers, find the skills they need to become gainfully employed.
Fascinating. I remember several months ago I had someone on from the Vermont Chamber of Commerce who was telling me that only 26% of the jobs available in Vermont require a college degree. And it sounds like a lot of the jobs you're training people for are the other 74%.
Well, that's right. That's absolutely right. Almost all of our trainees have some various barriers to employment. They haven't completed high school. They lack a credential that's recognized by the industry that they're interested in working in. Maybe they just have never held a job. They've been on public assistance. But they are committed to making a difference in their own lives. They want to support their families, and they've got to figure out how to do that. And then on the other side, we've got employers who are just saying, geez, we can't find any workers. We're advertising. We're doing this and that. And some of it is we're trying to find some of those employees who are underemployed or unemployed and move them into that gainful employment by teaching them skills, giving them new confidence, helping them overcome disabilities. I mean, many of the trainees we work with are actually have some sort of recognized disabilities. They may be blind. They may have other physical disabilities, which they need to figure out how to coping mechanisms so that they can work and be productive. So it's really is sort of there's a lot of different elements of our programs, but a lot of it boils down to just finding, helping to find and work with disadvantaged individuals who want to work and working with employers to figure out what the skills are that they need.
One of the barriers to work, of course, we hear so much about these days in Vermont, including from employers who express quite a bit of frustration sometimes about this, but high levels of addiction among Vermonters, opiate addiction or, you know, alcohol addiction, other issues like that. Are you working with folks who are trying to work their way out of those kinds of situations?
Absolutely. And so, you know, one of the things, you know, we're not a drug treatment provider. You know, that's not within our bag of tricks, so mm-hmm. to speak. But we, you know, if you are someone who's had coming out of recovery, you're trying to get back on your feet, it can be challenging to get a job because you haven't been sober, you haven't been working. Mm-hmm. The last job you had, you burn up in flames because you just were not reliable. So you have to rebuild, start from scratch, essentially. You have to gain new skills, a new career, possibly. Mm-hmm. You have to prove to yourself that you really can do this. And then you have to develop a resume where an employer is going to not look and see this big gap in your resume and wonder what the hell you've been doing the last 2 years. This makes me nervous. Mm-hmm. But instead, we need to help someone point to a resume where they can say, look, in the last 12 months, I've been doing all these things that have been helping the community. I think one of the important pieces of the way resource is structured is that our trainees are not just learning a skill in isolation, but they're doing it with a team, and that team is helping to relieve poverty and helping to protect the environment. And it's by doing all of those things together that we really transmit and help create a sense of pride for the students, because they are not just learning this, they're not doing this just for themselves. They're doing it because they want to help the community, they want to help the environment, they want to help relieve poverty. And by doing that, they actually help themselves because they gain this new confidence. They feel like, if I can do this through this program, I'm going to also be able to do this for an employer.
I was going to say, I mean, it's part of the trick here, and again, this is something else we hear sometimes from employers themselves, but finding somebody who will show up every day, yep, and show up on time. Two big challenges for a lot, yep, of folks.
Well, so, you know, in my job as executive director, you know, I'm not doing the day-to-day training, but one of the things I love doing is mock interviews. I get the chance to, you know, we do a little role playing. Mm-hmm. So I'll play the role of an employer who's looking for a candidate, and I'll be interviewing them. I'll then be able to turn around and give that trainee some feedback on their interview. And I just did that, you know, last week. And the young man who is about to graduate from our program, I would have hired him in a heartbeat. I mean, he was someone who was very committed. He wanted to be a team, be part of a company that was doing important work, where the team worked well together. They were happy. They were excited to be productive. I mean, it was just all these high points of what you would want as an employer, and it was really a joy. So, I appreciate that part of what we do because of the successes and the outcomes we achieve.
How many employees does Resource have?
We have about 85 employees, mm-hmm, and annually we have over 300 trainees go through one of our different training programs.
I see. Oh, wow. 244-1777 is the number here for the studio in Waterbury. If you'd like to call in any questions or comments you would like to for Tom Longstrath, the Executive Director of Resource to Hear. You're more than welcome to join the conversation out there, listeners. Hey, one thing I wanted to mention, don't forget about our podcast. If you're just tuning in now and say, boy, I wish I'd listened to this whole interview with Tom Longstrath from Resource, you can always go to our website, wdevradio.com. Follow the link from that homepage to the Dave Graham Show. Scroll down a bit. You'll come up with a list of our recent broadcasts by topic and by guest, and you will be able to figure out what you want to listen to first and second and third and all that good stuff. Any hours, day of night, you can only call us while we're here live in the studio between 9 and 11 a.m. But if it's just a matter of listening in, you are more than welcome to do that anytime via our podcast. Want to thank that Warren Store, the friendly, funky, and almost world-famous Warren Store, for their sponsorship of our podcast. All right, well, Tom Longstrath, your mission obviously is a really interesting one to me, and I'm wondering if you're just talk to me a little bit about the kind of juggling act, and do you ever feel any sense of conflict between, you know, is our mission really to do environmental protection vis-a-vis reducing the waste stream? Is it really to do job training? And then to also talk to us about how some of the specific work that is being done at Resource, how does that translate into the construction trades, which I understand is a big target for you moving people into the workforce?
Well, you know, you're right that there, you know, when you have a three-part mission, there are sometimes trade-offs and conflicts, or, you know, you're limited funds. You know, we're a nonprofit organization. We get a real mix of funding from some government, some charitable support from individuals, some foundation support. But, you know, the lion's share comes from our social enterprises. So people support that by giving us things they don't need anymore. And so we're able to keep those things out of the landfill, but then we're able to sell them, add value to them by sometimes repairing or refurbishing. So the challenge for us is to find that sweet spot where our trainees are learning new skills while also contributing to this larger purpose of poverty relief and keeping things out of the landfill. We're sometimes juggling those, and you sometimes are in a situation where, take an appliance trainee, you're trying to teach them to be an appliance technician. So you often start with a dryer because dryers are pretty simple.
Mm-hmm.
They get good at that. They start producing dryers. In some ways, you want to say, okay, let's just keep you on dryers. That's how you can be most productive. But because we're in workforce development, we need to move that trainee. Okay, you've mastered the dryers. Now you're going to move into washing machines or a stove. You know, learn gas and get certified in gas handling gas. Move into refrigeration. So we do juggle these different things. There's always different ways to balance those three elements, but it's really, that's the strength of it as well, because it makes the work meaningful to those trainees. So,
mm-hmm. And you're, we have a listener on the line. Karen from Hardwick is calling in. Good morning, Karen.
Good morning. I'm just curious, how do you protect your resold furniture, ensure that there's no bed bugs in it?
Oh, well, that's a good question. You know, a lot of people are concerned with bed bugs. We do a lot of training with our staff. We are able to identify the signs of a problem. We also are pretty careful in screening donations. And so, you know, we get donations from people who are certain that the items are used, but not contaminated. We have in the past done heat treatment of furniture, and we have also used a bed bug sniffing dog, Buster. Buster has passed away, so we don't have Buster's services anymore, but we used to be a training site for Buster. So, you know, but really now we rely on our staff who are all trained and know the telltale signs to look for. And we will, before bringing anything into any of our reuse stores, we will inspect it very carefully. And we haven't had any problems. So we feel like we're doing a good job on that.
Well, I'll feel better about shopping there. Thanks.
You're welcome.
Thanks for the call, Karen. Hey, Tom, Longstreth, interesting. Are you recruiting a new dog for bed bug sniffing? Or
We not actively, but you know, I think that we had a great relationship with. Someone was trying to train his dog, and so he used our facilities as his training site, and actually would put a bed bug in a vial. A sealed vial so it couldn't get out, and he knew he could recover it. And he would plant it throughout the store. And you know, our stores are, you know, have for a dog, it's a wonderful place. There's all these different smells.
Oh, yeah.
and you know, they, you know, I'm sure it was just a great training site for the dog. But, you know, if someone has a hound that they're interested in training, I think we would be thrilled to have that added bit of protection and security. So
sure, yeah, why not? That's something that hadn't occurred to me, but I guess with used furniture of any kind, or used a wide range of items, there are chances for various infestations and so on, including bed bugs.
Yeah. I wanted to. You had also asked before this caller about the construction trades.
Yeah, and let's get back to that because that's a really important link,
you know,
here.
And let me. We've had for a long time. We've had what we call Youth Build, which is a national model program. There works with 16 to 24 year old youth who've all dropped out of high school. The program over 12 months give them a chance to get their high school degree or at least gain a couple grade levels. So we work with partner agencies, Vermont Adult Learning and Central Vermont Adult Basic Ed, to get them their degrees along with the sending high schools and the Vermont High School Completion Program. So half the time of those students is in the classroom, but the other half is out on the job site. The way we structure it is that they're either doing weatherization work or they're building affordable housing. So that hits all parts of our mission, right? So we've got the trainees learning a new skill. We're building affordable housing. So the students feel good because they know that what they're building or the home they're weatherizing is going to be the beneficiaries of that are low-income families. And that motivates them to work harder and improve their skills. The trainees all get this NCCER certification in construction, and then we place them into jobs. And the you know, not all the students go into construction, probably about half do, but they all are equipped with critical job skills that are transferable to other careers. Because the Youth Build program is a year long, very intensive, and because only half the students are going into construction, we were realizing that we just aren't graduating enough trainees to really make a difference in this economy with such a strong demand and such an aging population. So a year ago, we created what we call Construction 101. And it's a, sort of the model is an intensive six-week training program that takes people who of all ages and gets them into jobs. We teach the NCCER certification. They gain practice doing construction work, and then they're placed with an employer. And in fact, many employers are paying us to part of the cost of running these training programs. We also work with the Vermont Department of Labor, and it's been extremely successful. And we, in fact, pay the students a stipend because many of the disadvantaged trainees, they can't afford to not work for 6 weeks. And so we're able, with the various funding sources that we've pieced together, to provide a stipend, a living stipend, to the students during the coursework.
One question I had for you, Tom, I'm having a little trouble framing it exactly, but it's something like this, which is, if I'm working in a resource facility and I'm, let's say, restoring washers and dryers and getting them working and functioning again, and I'm thinking about a career in construction, now I'm imagining myself hanging kitchen cabinets or framing a house or maybe doing electrical or plumbing work or that kind of thing. How does the work that you are doing at Resource going to translate into that other type of work?
Well, maybe I just clarification, because we really have multiple tracks. Mm-hmm. Because we have so many trainees with different interests and employers, a really diverse group of employers who need different types of employees. Our appliance trainees are not going to end up in construction normally. I mean, they're going to end up as technicians. And
In large appliances,
okay. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Our youth build and our construction 101 trainees are going to go into construction. You know, okay. They're going to be, you know, framing homes, installing windows, doors, that type of work.
Okay. So I just needed to sort these things out in my own mind.
No, I understand. I mean, you know, we also do. We're an authorized Microsoft refurbisher. We have a computer reuse program. And we're teaching skills to people who want to get into computers. Mm-hmm. And some of those skills are just very broad. And you know, we have people who are, you know, the computer repair and the small appliance repair, that becomes sort of the vehicle for just general skills. Unlike the appliance or construction trades, which is a very specific technical, where we're doing both soft and hard skills.
Wow! So you've really got multiple tracks going on, and it sounds like an organization that is well worth reaching out to, folks. I'm sure that they would not turn down public donations if you want to reach out in that way, or if you know somebody who is betwixt and between in terms of what kind of a job or career they might want to be pursuing, and another reason to reach out to Resource. If folks want to do that and contact you, what's the best way to do that, Tom?
You know, I think our website, resourcevt.org, is really the best way to get in touch with us, because you can find our phone numbers there. We offer free pickups for furniture, housewares, other things. You find out the hours. Many of our locations are open 7 days a week. And you can find out who to contact if you're interested in one of the training programs and what types of training programs we offer. And in fact, if you're an employer and you need trainees, you need employees, you also can find out who to contact through that.
resourcevt.org.
That's right. Resource, the word resource.
Yep.
VT.org. That's it.
All righty. Well, it sounds like definitely worth checking out, folks. So don't be shy. And Tom Longstreth, really appreciate you coming in this morning and talking to me about the work that you're doing. You've been at it, I guess, at Resource for 25 years or so, 24 years?
Almost 25 years. That's right. Yeah, I'm getting there. That's why there's not so much hair left on the top of my head. But, Dave, I really appreciate your having us on the show. I appreciate all the support we get from so many Vermonters.
Sounds good. That's about it for today's edition of the Dave Graham Show. Have a great afternoon, everybody. We'll talk to you all again tomorrow.